What's up, guys? Welcome to this very special episode of Unemployable. Today, I am joined by an Australian icon, former professional tennis player, politician for the Liberal Party, and just all around great guy, John Alexander. You've probably seen him on TV commentating the tennis. You may have seen him in politics. But today we have a very wide-ranging talk about how to fix so many of the pressing issues that many of you talk about out there in the real world of Australia. We talk about high-speed rail, value capture, why that is important to the future of this country in bringing the cost of living down, in giving more Australians the opportunity to own a piece of this great country, and the impact that home ownership has on the psychology of them, and also the impact in communities and how people behave differently when they are able to afford a place to live. And we have some really great actual solutions proposed in this pod. We talk about a whole bunch of other stuff, leadership solutions, and a whole bunch more. It's rare that we get an Australian with this level of experience, integrity, quality of thought, that is willing to listen to both sides of the political aisle for the one agenda that you'll hear us raise, which is for the commonwealth of Australians. You're going to love this podcast. Sit all the way through the end. And if you like it, subscribe, drop a comment, and share the pod with other Australians that actually give a shit about the future of this country. With that said, please enjoy this interview with John Alexander. John, welcome to the podcast, and really, really appreciate you making time for us this morning. John, for those who don't know you, a lot of Aussies of a certain age will definitely know who you are, but you know, the world's moving along. There's a lot of young people now coming up. Could you just give us a snapshot about your background in Australian political and sporting life, just to sort of frame up, you know, your experience before we jump into this chat? I'd really value that.
Well, I started off my working life as a tennis player, being paid $5 a day, traveling with Harry Hopman. And the first year I played was the first year of open tennis, 1968. And I was involved in international tennis and Davis Cup representation from then until about 1985. And then I went into sports club development, the next generation clubs, our first one at Memorial Drive, and they were very successful. And then by chance, and it really was by chance, I was lured into politics. I attended a friend's, Bob Gilton, who was looking for some fundraising for his attempt to get involved in local council. And I was the MC and the auctioneer. And there was a woman there from the Liberal Party, Dr. Carolyn Curry, who thought I'd make a good politician based on the way that I sold Pat Rafter's sweaty T-shirt for $400. I'm the most accidental politician of all time.
And you served in the seat of Bennelong for a number of years in Sydney. And basically, you were born and raised in Australia, right? Through your whole life, right?
Yep, I'm a Northern Beaches boy from Narrabeen.
Yeah, good stuff. The reason I wanted to just frame that up, John, is, you know, I really value any opportunity to sit down with Aussies that have been around a while and have seen this great country go through a few cycles and a few iterations and a few changes. And we connected when you rang my phone, and I was on a beachfront in Cyprus, actually, when you rang me. And we just talked about, you know, the state of affairs in Australia, and guys like you that have had that context, grew up in Australia, served in politics, played in sport at the highest level, done all of those, you know, really Australian things, and won the Order of Australian Medal. It's really valuable to have your perspective on where we are and things now. So maybe let's bring the viewers up to speed with why we actually connected, because I've been getting calls from folks like you that have been around a while and love this great country of Australia. But at this moment in time, there's a high degree of frustration. How are you feeling as a proud Aussie at the moment as a result of the last election, both sides of the political aisle? What are you seeing? What are you feeling? What are your friends talking about?
I'm dismayed and I'm frustrated. I watched the last election campaign. I didn't see from either party, and I've got friends on both sides, any vision for this great country, you know, any ideas of how to fulfill our potential. The problem that I suffered through in my nearly 12 years in Parliament was there was just this culture of denigrating the other side. It wasn't a contest of ideas, it wasn't a contest of vision. And I often thought that, you know, if any great ideas came along, they would die on the political battlefield. And that's probably one of the reasons I was so attracted to Philip Lowe when answering a question. He was asked, you know, what should happen, you know, to get major infrastructure up? And his answer was that if 40 years ago somebody would have told you that my board and I would set the prime rate of interest at arm's length from government, people would have laughed at you. But that type of body, institution, is what's required to get major infrastructure projects up. And you know, the greatest example of, you know, political failure was recently when we had the referendum. We couldn't even agree that our Indigenous people were the first people of this country. And that just shows you how the political system, the negativity, just isn't producing a result on anything.
Sorry, didn't see you there. While you're here, actually, we've got a new coaching cohort that just opened up for the Unemployable Property Coaching Program that you get taught on how to become a property developer. One-on-one coaching, bi-monthly coaching, and also events where we get a full coach bus with all the students and go to 6, 7 different development sites. When I say development sites, from one lot to 10 lots to 50 lots, you get to see exactly why we buy it, how we buy it, how we fund it, and also how you can do it yourself. The next day, we had an amazing event at the QT Hotel here on the Gold Coast, where we had all of our consultants come in and teach everybody on what they're looking for with sites, what are the different trends, and how you can become a property developer yourself. Now, you see me on the video, but who you're gonna be getting coached by is Shannon and Carson. Who's Shannon and Carson? 4 years ago, Carson was cleaning carpets. Shannon was a machine operator. Today, they're doing over $100 million worth of land deals. I know you're listening, and I know you want to take action. And if that's you, click on the link below or go to www.unemployablepropery.com.au and register your interest, and one of our team will reach out to you, and we'll see you on the next bus. Now get out of here.
Well, why do you think that, you know, like, where did we go wrong? Like, I agree with you. Like, there was, like, both sides of the aisle were horrible choices, I think, for the average Australian punter. But do you think that this is there any way to fix this culture of just, like, how bad does it have to get? Do you think it has to get super bad before we start to change our political trajectory, and we start to really look for and embrace solutions rather than just being right? Do you see any answers to that problem?
Well, yes, I see the answer to it would be as Philip Lowe recommended, that to get major policy and major infrastructure projects up, it needs to be put in the hands of a body, a neutral body like a reserve bank institution. Because if it's put onto the political battlefield, all good ideas die. We have been debating climate change and energy for over 40 years. We have spent 45 years doing inquiries into the high-speed rail and spent more money, over $140 million, on these inquiries, and we are no closer. And the High Speed Rail Authority, who I engage with, has not accepted any of the recommendations that came from three parliamentary inquiries as to how to go about high speed rail. One of the key findings was that high speed rail everywhere in the world is funded through value capture. And yet the business model that supposedly was delivered to Catherine King, the minister, prior to Christmas, has not been, the business case hasn't been released. And I can promise you, there is no value capture mechanism to fund high speed rail in their work. So it can't work. So it's another major project that will die.
So I want to jump into value capture, because this has been something that you've really done a lot of work on. I read all the reports that you sent me prior to the podcast, and it's fascinating. Before we jump into what value capture is and why it's so powerful and potentially important, for those who are just joining this discussion, because a lot of our audience are just everyday people that are just trying to get by in this expensive and getting more expensive world, why is high-speed rail such an important infrastructure project for Australia? What are the downstream benefits for the average person?
Well, the purpose of high-speed rail is essentially not to get from Sydney to Melbourne, as might be put forward. It is to reduce congestion, housing costs from our major cities, and bring prosperity to regional areas, to actually have a plan of settlement to strategically decentralize and open up new cities and an abundance of affordable housing. That's the goal of high speed. The need for high speed rail is to effect a plan of settlement, a strategic plan of decentralization to create housing supply. We've got two of the most expensive cities in the world. Sydney is second most expensive city in the world to buy a house to Hong Kong, and we're closing in on Hong Kong, and Melbourne's not far behind. And now, as of today, I think Perth is catching up. It's an absurd situation when our biggest asset is actually land, and yet our land prices are the second highest in the world. So the need to create new housing supply in regional areas and capture the uplift that is created when you establish high-speed rail stations. We did an inquiry called Fairer Funding and Financing of Faster Rail, and we had a lot of evidence from what happened to land values around Badgerys Creek with the advent of the Western Sydney Airport, and what happens when you put a train station, a metro station, in the middle of what was a dairy farm. And people just do not understand that the level of uplift, but the up is stupendous. Land that was previously valued around $2,000 an acre or whatever a dairy farm is worth, when you put a metro station there and zone for high-rise development, that land goes to being worth beyond $10 million an acre or $20 million an acre. The uplift is not 1,000%, it's thousands of times. And the people who are listening, they should understand the travesty here is that this is a mechanism. In the absence of value capture, it is a mechanism to concentrate wealth amongst the landowners and the speculators funded by the taxpayer. So the taxpayer puts in $25, $30 billion to build an airport and rail and various other things, and it's the lucky landowner, the speculator, who takes all the uplift, and there's no mechanism in place to capture some share of the uplift. Our inquiry found that had the Western Sydney Airport been under the laws of the ACT, which collects 75% of uplift on rezoned land, that the airport and all the infrastructure would have been paid for just under that. But there was an absence of such a mechanism.
So I want to dive into that more. And I think for the listeners, because this is the kind of, you know, I get it all day long. Australians are just tired of not seeing any value capture in things like this. And also our natural resources, we're hearing it all the time, constantly in the media and in our pod. But I want to dive into that a bit deeper, but I just want people to actually understand, like in practical terms, if we could get a high-speed rail, what sort of cities that are currently not really connected, people don't want to go there because they're too far. Can you give us a couple of practical examples of like a regional city and how much time it would take, for example, to get on a high-speed rail, like from Ipswich to Brisbane or further? Like how quickly, how would it change the gap in real terms?
Certainly. Think of the Central Coast, the Gosford region, Aroombah region into Sydney. 15, 16 minutes from the Southern Highlands into the city, 17 or 18 minutes from Goulburn into the city, 30 minutes.
Wow.
40 minutes from Newcastle to Sydney. One of the interesting parts of our inquiry, we held an inquiry one day in Newcastle, and it started off by suggesting that with high-speed rail connectivity, because Newcastle has no geographical limitations, that Newcastle in time would be a bigger urban area than Sydney, and when connected with Sydney and the Southern Highlands and the Central Coast, this would create a mega region of over 15 million people. But the advantage of Newcastle is, you know, there's about 280,000 people there or so. There is the chance to actually proactively plan the urban development, as opposed to what we see in Sydney, where we're endlessly retrofitting infrastructure, where it's so difficult to do because to resume land, you're looking at the most expensive land in the world. So that doesn't happen very often. When you don't do that, you tunnel. And when tunnel's too expensive, nothing happens. We have spent billions upon billions of dollars of retrofitting infrastructure into Sydney. Try driving onto the Sydney Harbour Bridge these days. It is a mess. And all of the tunnels that have been built, the toll roads, most tolled city in the world. Retrofitting of infrastructure is always very, very expensive and never very effective. So the need to ease the pressure on our major cities by strategically decentralizing and creating new great cities that have that commutable time into these cities of Sydney and Melbourne and Brisbane in time is absolute and essential. It should be an absolute priority. When you look at our need for immigration, immigration must be calibrated to your housing supply. So to increase housing supply, we need to decentralize. We need to open up these regional areas to create more affordable housing. And then you can calibrate your immigration to that. But at the moment, we've got a housing shortage. We're bringing in 600,000 people in a year. It's quite interesting. You know how many people come into the US a year? 1 million.
No.
And look at how many. Wow. We're a tiny part of that. We've got 600,000 coming in. You know, wake up.
So America has 1 million immigrants a year and Australia has 600,000.
That's my understanding, sad as it is.
Oh, my God, that puts it in perspective, because the US population is 13 times the size of Australia. So that's just, wow. I didn't know that, and that's amazing. Even if it's half right, that's amazing. Wow, I didn't know that. So, John, I mean, what you're talking about here is the kind of, like, I sat through a presentation 2 weeks ago from a company in Dubai called EMA, and they're a huge real estate development company, and they laid out the vision that the Dubai government and the Emirates states have for their future over the next 20, 30 years. And it is nothing short of absolutely inspiring. And when you think of what they're working with a dust bowl, like literally sand. And in Australia, we have this incredible natural resource, beautiful country, everywhere up and down, well, everywhere, but up and down that East Coast where you're talking about. If that happened, high-speed rail, when you describe it in those terms, Newcastle to Sydney, it reshapes the entire nation. It reshapes the way Australians think about the country. There are so millions of Australians commuting 40 minutes a day now in cars and on trains to the outer suburbs of Sydney and Melbourne as it is. It's just absolutely an incredible idea. So, well, I hope for the listeners, you realize how powerful this actually is. So, sorry, John, carry on.
Yeah, it's questionable. The decision that high-speed rail is going to be kicked off between Sydney and Newcastle, it should have been a decision made at arm's length from politics. That was a political decision. And then, you know, the high-speed rail authority has to work with that. It's the most expensive terrain to establish high-speed rail, especially when you're going from Central to Gosford Town Centre to Broadmeadow. Our recommendations from our inquiries would say the location of the stations is a very important issue to maximise the opportunity for uplift in the value of land. So Central doesn't have much of a chance. It's also very expensive going from there. Nearly every group that gave evidence suggested that the high-speed rail terminal should most likely be in Homebush Bay. It certainly shouldn't go into Gosford you should be placing that high-speed rail station where you can create a million people city, somewhere west of Arimba or in that area there, not, you know, five levels under the Gosford station. There's no, you know, you're limited how much development you can do there. And certainly it should have been west of Newcastle, because that is on its way to Brisbane. So going into Broadmeadow, it's expensive to go into Broadmeadow, it's expensive to go north from Broadmeadow. So they've been diametrically opposed to the recommendations that the government was a part of. There was no dissenting reports in any of the three parliamentary inquiries that we did into this subject, from harnessing value, delivering an infrastructure, to fairer funding and financing faster rail, and I think it was building up and moving out, which was a very, very good inquiry, which was talking about the building up and the densifying around infrastructure in our major cities, but more importantly, the moving out and strategically decentralizing, which was, you know, seen as the future for housing supply in Australia.
Interesting. And so let's talk about value capture in a little bit more detail, because this is a really interesting idea. So the idea is you basically, I heard Howard Lutnick talking about this in the US, right? So he's the Treasury Commerce. Basically, Elon, for the listeners, was responsible for trying to cut the budget, and Howard was responsible for trying to add $1 trillion, and Elon was trying to save $1 trillion out of their budgets. That's basically the two of them. And so he talked about how he wants American people to value capture in all kinds of ways, from land zoning to, if the government grants a contract to a company, they should be able to participate in the uplift of that company as a nation, you know, when they award a contract. It's just a really interesting way to look at, you know, government interacting with private. So how does it practically work in Australia? Let's say for this got agreed that we're going to build this high-speed rail. Obviously, they have to take land. Is that how it works? Or
No. It's beautiful. It's looking at the unearned beneficiaries. So you've got people who own land, mm-hmm. and then through their good luck, there's going to be a high-speed rail station established there, and there's going to be zoning that's appropriate to the high-speed rail station. So right around the high-speed station, there'll be high-rise, then medium density, and then suburban areas in this new city that's being created. So it doesn't touch anyone's existing housing. If you're in the hamlet of Mossvale or Barrel, and your house value is going to go up because you've now got high-speed rail at your doorstep to go into town, great, that's your good luck. But the land that has been rezoned, that's outside where the station is going to go, that's the land that is subject to a charge. Professor Andrew McNaughton gave fantastic evidence. He's the head of High Speed Rail 2 and a leading thinker in value capture. And his advice, and he made a final statement, and the statement was, before you make any announcements as to where a train station might be located, you must establish the current value of the land before you make any announcements. Because once you make an announcement, 1 minute later, it's too late. So you've got to establish the current value of the land that you might make a charge on. So you can give the example of, you know, somebody's got a farm outside of Goulburn, and they might have bought it 5 years ago, 100 acres for $100,000. And now that 100 acres is really close to the train station, and each acre might be worth $2 million. We'll call it $2 million. So it's now worth $200 million. So he's paid $100,000, and there's $200 million uplift. Now, mm-hmm. even if the government was only to take 75%, that lucky person would be walking away with, what, $50 million. I mean, mm-hmm. he's doing too well. So you've got to really look at how this should be calibrated. In Canberra, it's 75%, and then the rest is also subject to capital gains tax. But everyone can be a winner. The lucky landowner can be a winner. The speculator who gets in there can be a winner. But they don't take 100% of the uplift that's been funded by the taxpayer. The government must be responsible when they invest the taxpayers' money. They should be looking at a fair return. And this is how you do it. And in the absence of it, you're putting in a mechanism like negative gearing does, and you're forcing people into renting who are paying for the uplift and the ownership of that property to the landlord. And that's another mechanism that concentrates wealth, which is closely related to this idea of when you don't have value capture, you're concentrating wealth amongst the landowners. It's terribly unfair to the taxpayers that governments, you know, are charged with actually looking after their interests. And it will fund high-speed rail. It doesn't only just fund it. It funds the schools, it funds the dams, it funds the hospitals, the universities, and anything else you want to put in. And after you've paid for it and it's running, it will still, for decades and decades and decades, continue to produce enormous revenues that GST could be shared with other states that aren't getting high-speed rail at this point.
So, look, I'm going to ask the dumb questions, right? Because I don't know a lot about, you know, these types of transactions where the government knocks on a landowner's door and says, hey, listen, this is what's happening. But essentially, it's kind of the way I'm thinking about this is the government is like a developer and it's shareholders of the Australian public. And it basically says, right, the developer, being the government, sort of says to this landowner, right, we're going to put a high-speed rail through here. Is it a resumption order or something? They said, look, we're going to take this land.
No.
But isn't it owned by them?
Owned. The landowner owns it.
Right.
And the chap from Goulburn who's got the 100 acres, it's his choice whether he wants to sell it for the 200 million or keep it. He can do whatever he wants. I think he'd probably sell it.
Yeah.
And then if you brought in a land tax, which should be there, that would give encouragement to sell it because now the land tax would be on the 200 million, not the 100,000. But that aside, you know, if you think logically, if you're a bloke, a gal who's bought some, you know, beautiful 100 acres outside of Goulburn, the Southern Highlands or something, and now it's the train station's coming, your land has been rezoned, and it's worth this stupendous amount of money, are you really going to sit there and not take that $100 million or $200 million?
Is that is that coming from the government or is that coming, government buy it?
No, the government doesn't buy it. It's the developer buys it.
Yeah. Okay.
The land is now zoned medium density housing.
Yeah.
It's got a value of, $1 or $2 million per acre, understanding that a 600 square meter block of land in Sydney is currently valued at $2 million. That's all of a quarter an acre. So you're looking at, if you're having it a quarter of that price, it's still going to be a couple of million dollars an acre. And the developer buys it. It's the government can have already zoned it and approved it for development. And so the work has been done on behalf of the developer who's got the planning approval, got the zoning, and can buy it off the farmer for this amount of money. It's divided up into 400 building sites, and they sell the 400 building sites off and make a nice profit.
Yes, and so the government gets their bit by way of a tax on that transaction. Is that right? And then that revenue then goes to build the infrastructure.
That's correct. The Goulburn farmer who bought it for 100,000, sold it for 200 million. There is a charge on that 200 million.
As he sells it down. 75%,
if it is 75%, that farmer would be walking away with $50 million, which would then be still subject to capital gains tax, but they're going to be walking away with like $30 million for an investment of $100,000. They're doing awfully, awfully well.
So the farmer would then sort of say, okay, I'm going to sell this whole district here to a land developer, then another district maybe like to a commercial developer who wants to build, home centre, that kind of thing. And he sells it off and there's a tax on those sales that were a specific value capture tax or something. And then the government with that revenue can build the infrastructure and everybody wins. That's basically it.
That's right. It's funding, not just the high-speed rail, but the other infrastructure, the provision of water, of power, of roads, of schools, of hospitals, Whatever is decided that the planning of that community, the proactive planning. We don't do planning in Australia. We only ever react, but we need to move into a proactive mindset for planning. And you're saying, well, we're looking at this area. We've got a clean sheet of paper. We're going to put this train station here. We're going to have a CBD here that's going to be 20 minutes from the CBD of Sydney. We're going to have high-rise development around here, so that land will be worth an enormous amount, medium density around there, and you plan the new settlement.
So is that land capture legislation that's not in place at the moment, right? There's no mechanism for the government to apply this tax in instances where the government approves major infrastructure projects. It's not in place at the moment?
Victoria has put in an impost of, I think it's 66% on lands that are rezoned. And New South Wales was certainly looking at putting in a similar impost on lands that were rezoned or the beneficiary of infrastructure.
I'm not surprised Victoria is first to tax its residents.
Yeah.
They're the world champions, mate. They're the gold medalists.
But this is an equitable charge. This is not, what stamp duty? I mean, most ridiculous charge of all time. This is fair and equitable. No, everybody's winning. They've got certainty. The landowner is winning because they're being told your land is being rezoned. Don't sell it as $100,000, 100 acres. It's now going to be rezoned. It's worth a lot more. Be warned, but when you do sell it for this enormous price, it will be subject to a value capture charge.
Yes, and so this high speed rail is actually like such a key, right? Like it redraws the lines of how people think about Australia as a nation, and it sort of enables this enormous unlock of affordable housing. Funded by the profit that is created through the government's initiative, and the shareholders of the government being the Australian people benefit, which is wonderful. And it blows my mind that this kind of logic dies on the political battlefield, as you said. Like, where are the losers in that situation? Like, what's the arguments against this?
I can go back to days when Dad and I used to deliver television sets in the Northern Beaches area. And he used to talk to me. I was probably about 7 or 8 years of age at the time. I was cheap labour. And he'd say that the barometer of the well-being of Australia was the percentage of home ownership. And during those years after the Second World War, we went from under 40% of home ownership to over 70% of home ownership. And that gave people, they had ownership of their community. They were invested in their community. They were more solid citizens. They were more stable families. They were more stable workforce. It was a golden era. But we're now at a time of having the lowest rate of home ownership in over 60 years. Young people have given up the opportunity. Oh, we'll never afford to be able to buy a house. They're trapped in renting, and every year they rent, they get further away from being able to buy unless there is serious change. And the first serious change that's got to happen is you've got to create a supply of affordable housing. So when you're looking at dividing up land that was, just hundreds of dollars per acre, to the rezoning and the advent of the high-speed rail, where it'll still be, a fifth or less than what it would cost in Sydney, but be actually a shorter commutable time than many areas in Sydney. So that will add value to those lands.
What I mean, you're in Sydney, you're in the thick of it, you've been in the highest levels of politics and sport, and all your mates and network are, the who's who of Australia. What do they make of Australia right now with these pressing challenges of housing affordability, the breakdown in like young people? I mean, it's not just housing. It's they're not having kids. They're not reproducing. The Australia that we had is being lost. Like, what do you guys make of it you know, you guys have been the beneficiaries of it in some ways. And a lot, there's this culture that I think is very toxic creeping in, where they're hating the boomers and they're hating. What do you make of it from where you sit? Like, what are you saying to your grandkids, and how are your mates talking about these problems?
It is so unfair. I've visited old friends. That's the only type of friends I've got now are old ones in California. And I said to Ross Case, you know, terrific tennis player, great champion person. And I said, oh, look, my daughter and son-in-law just bought a townhouse in Redfern. I said, what do you think it cost? He said, I don't know. I know the price has gone up a lot. You know, I said, it's nice. Yeah, it's sort of two bedroom, you know, 100-year-old little place. Oh, he said, gee, well, probably what, 400,000 or 500,000? No, $2.8 million, a mortgage of $2 million. And what my colleagues didn't understand this, that in Australia, when the Reserve Bank puts up an interest rate, 80% are on a variable rate. And so it goes up the next Tuesday, right? And then what compounds the problem, it's also got to be paid with after-tax dollars. What they don't realize, in the US, your mortgage on your home is tax deductible, and you have 30-year fixed rate mortgages. So when their central bank puts up interest rates, it doesn't affect anyone who's got an existing mortgage. I mean, yeah. Our system is so volatile that here's this young couple who do awfully well, awfully well. But their mortgage has gone from, what, 40,000 a year to 120,000 a year after tax. So they're going to make 240 to be able to pay the 140. I mean, this is, you know, how can you make any plans? How can you live with that? It's just, you know, when you looked at that program called Nemesis that they did on, you know, the Liberal Party years, my take from that was, gee, they're spending a lot of time backstabbing each other and the other side. When are they ever doing the work? When are they looking at these challenges and putting their mind to it to find better solutions? When these solutions are available, other parts of the world do things like this, but not here. I mean, it's, you know, the real estate market is concentrating. It's going the way of the US, where, you know, a tiny percentage of people own, you know, 90% of the assets in the US. An enormous concentration of wealth, which I think is at the heart of the unrest in the US. That's what's creating this tension. You know, there is going to be, one of the things I say to one of my mates over there is, the problem in America is the have-nots have guns. Mm-hmm. And you can just see that the tensions, you know, getting to a tipping point, and it could become really unpleasant. But it's because of the division of wealth, the haves and the have-nots.
I can feel it in Australian life. Like, I can feel it on the roads. I can feel it in the underlying tension of Australians. That easygoing Aussie mentality has slipped away under the weight of the cost of living. And a lot of young people listening to this, I want you to hear what John's been saying. He's a beneficiary of it. I'm a beneficiary of that boom, but we're not happy about it. I lived in the US for 5 years, and I can tell you that when the middle class gets hollowed out, it is not a better country to live in. It's sad.
And compare it to China. America has had 100 million or more go from middle class to poverty. And China has had hundreds of millions go from poverty to middle class. Mm-hmm. And yet we get brainwashed into being told, oh, China's a really bad place and America's a really great place. Well, America's not doing great these days. It's not the country that I knew. I was a green card holder. I spent a lot of time there from 1968 till 1986. And it was a great country. It was fair. The housing was unbelievably cheap. Cost of living was low. And they were making enormous strides in some of the things that Australians would have thought were particularly unpleasant, particularly in regard to discrimination. We had a great black American tennis player by the name of Arthur Ashe. We traveled with, we're great friends with, and we had this poignant moment where we were playing in Richmond, Virginia, where he came from. We're playing at the country club, practicing at the country club in Richmond, Virginia, where his dad used to be a janitor. and he was the first colored person ever allowed to play tennis at that place and dine in the restaurant. And by the end of the week, so many of the members saying, gee, Arthur, you know, they're really surprised. He's a really good guy, isn't he? I said, yeah, really good guy, actually. Except if you're playing tennis against him, he was generally too good. But other than that, yeah, terrific bloke. But he led that, you know, it was a huge part of that movement to, you know, forge equality and get rid of the racism that was rife against black people in the US.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. America, I always say, has a great marketing department in Hollywood, but when you actually go there these days, it is not the country that it once was, and it's really quite terrifying. And for me, when I've studied this deeply, when they went off the gold standard, that's when everything started to decline from that point on, when money was able to be printed infinitum, inflation set in, and those who had the assets and had access to the free money win, and everybody else is lost. And unfortunately, in Australia, unless we get some significant new ideas like what you're talking about here, I am not super excited about where we're heading as a country. We need real intervention.
We need to rebirth Commonwealth of Australia. Literally, wealth can be and should be common in Australia, therefore Commonwealth. Yeah, at the moment, you've got to drop that name common. It's just Australia. We're going towards being a kingdom. The way we're going, what actually happens in the end is one person owns everything. If you don't put in mechanisms to tame this, you know, extraordinary, you know, beast that is, you know, the biggest economic sector is housing. And it was very interesting. There was a comment by Hank Paulson when they all got together 10 years after the global financial crisis. And his comment was, you know, really the origins of this crisis was when housing went to be for a sector that was for shelter to being an investment sector. And I had to think, oh, yeah, and how long has it been an investment sector in Australia? Even those that are buying a house for their home, it's really both eyes firmly on this is our way to get rich. We'll own this home. It doubles every 7 years, and it's not taxable, and this is where we get rich. And then you've got the big shift. I think it was used to be a third, a third, a third. There was a third that was owned outright, a third that was on a mortgage, and a third that was investment properties. But that investment properties are knocking on 40% now. And so that's a rapid change in a relatively short period of time. But unless it is addressed and arrested and better laws put in place to give a fair go to the next generation to buy a stake in Australia, we will really suffer.
I've never heard that turn of phrase, how you just put it before, Commonwealth. I've heard it a million times, obviously. I grew up in Australia, sang the national anthem every week at school, you know. But I've never heard it really, it really rings true and hits hard, hits different now in the world, the Australia that we have today, Commonwealth. And of all nations, it is a country that should have enormous Commonwealth. You know, I've interviewed John Howard twice. By the way, you look like you could almost be his younger brother. It's amazing the resemblance of the two of you. But he said to me when I sat in his office there in Sydney overlooking the harbour, he looked out the window and he said, Adam, we are just so blessed with our resources in this country. You know, the number of times that it has saved us. But it just doesn't seem to be trickling down. We have this enormous, we have a beautiful infrastructure. We're safe. We don't have guns. There's so many where it's placed, politically placed or geographically placed in the world. It's such an amazing nation that is just being absolutely ruined by lack of leadership and lack of a contest of ideas. And I think social media has pushed everybody to the edges. It's like nobody wants to be in the middle. Like I've interviewed you and you said openly just here, both sides of the political aisle were disappointing. I interviewed, what's his name last week? I sent you the link to it. But he was saying, very, very wealthy Sydney business guy, hundreds of millions of dollar net worth. And he said, I actually have been doing work with the Greens and I nearly fell off my chair. Like when was the last time you heard a guy on the rich list say that he was working with the Greens, right? And he said, because in this particular area, it's better for Australia what they're proposing. And I was like, wow, this is incredible. This is what we need. We need more people willing to sit down and have a contest of ideas to create a vision for this country and put politics to the side for a minute, because it's just like, honestly, it's such a tragedy what's happening. It's just...
I was arguing with the Assistant Minister for Housing, I think it was Alex Hawke, and saying this is what's happening. This can be arrested through having a mechanism that can be adjusted to control investor-driven inflation by adjusting the percentage of deductibility of that investment until you can cool the market down and gradually allow the home buyer to come back into the market. And Alex said, we're good friends, we played squash together, and he said, hey, you're in the wrong party. And I said, oh, very well, I can arrange that to change by midday. I think it was about 11 o'clock. I used to play tennis with Albanese. Yeah, just sort of attack me on, oh, this isn't our doctrine. No, this is good policy. If you're going to get, I argued with Tony Abbott, who I thought was a really decent person. Didn't stop me from arguing with him. I said, yeah, how many votes do you get if you get a young couple in a house, Tony? He said, oh, well, two. I said, no, you don't. You get eight. How do you work that out, John? I said, well, every person these days has two biological parents. Nearly everyone's got a step-parent as well. So you've got two parents for the one partner, two parents for the other. And that's you've got the couple, you've got six, and then you've got two step-parents. So you've got eight people that are going to vote. This is the greatest vote winner of all time. But you're winning because it is a good policy that's allowing young people that buy into Australia, that taking a stake in Australia, having all of the benefits that come from home ownership. And it might seem, oh, well, it's a bit old and it's a bit quaint. Rubbish. It's a classic. It is a foundation of a person's self-esteem. George Bush Sr. had a HUD system in the US policy that allowed people to buy their housing that they were living in, the social housing. And the difference in personal self-esteem when these people had never owned their property, divorce rates went down, graffiti didn't happen, crime didn't happen, unemployment didn't happen. They owned something, they were proud of it, they treasured, they invested in their community. That when you own a place in a community, you're invested in it. You do things for the community, you go on the Clean Up Australia days and things like that. Yeah, if you rent a car, you wash it, no. But, and that's what happens with the renter. They're not invested in their community, and it is a great shame. It's a loss of social fabric.
Yeah, there are other problems, John, that stem from it as well, that I've read about, things like military enrollment in countries where there's low home ownership, they struggle to get people to enroll in the military because they don't feel like they own part of the country. They don't feel like they're part of it. And I'm seeing it now. It's starting to even move the other way, where there's people who do own that are starting to sell because the taxes that are coming in, it's just all a mess. And they're just going, I don't want the stuff anymore. It's an experiment, that's for sure. But when I look to other developed nations where this divide between the rich and the poor has just gotten worse, and like you said, in the end, one person owns it all at the moment. It's a BlackRock-type entity that just sucks in like the Death Star, all the capital, all the assets, and there's just the rich and the uber rich, the uber elite, and then there's the poor, and it's not a great country. So, I think young people listening to this, I just want you to hear that it's, very easy to villainize the people, the boomers that have benefited from this, but don't think for a minute that they're all delighted about this either, because they're not. They've got kids, they've got grandkids. They want those kids and grandkids to have a go, John, what do you encourage, people in your family circles who are younger? Like at this point in your life, you've probably made your money, you're okay, right? Like it was Jeff Wilson that I was talking to last week, and he was saying he'd been working with the Greens, and it blew me away. But what do you say to these young people? Like, what should they be doing to ensure a better Australia for the future? What should we be doing to sort of get this back on track? What can we do? Is it voting? Is it being more politically active? What do we do? How do we help? Do we demand competition of ideas? How do we facilitate change?
Well, yeah, we desperately need to have a genuine, that place in Canberra should be an arena for a contest of ideas, and you've got to educate people to so that they understand how wrong negative gearing is and the way that it's developed and at the cost of the renter who gets further away from ever owning a property. And how do you turn that around without crashing the market? Bill Shorten's concept some years ago would have crashed the market by only allowing new properties to be negatively geared. Well, you only negatively gear to sell for a profit. So if you can buy a new property and can only sell it to a homeowner and not an investor, you're not going to sell it for a profit. And so that would have certainly crashed the market. But the inquiry that I did into home ownership, which was still birthed, unfortunately, we had a lot of engagement from Glenn Stevens and the Secretary of the Treasury, I think it was John Fraser, and others. But to have this idea of having a lever that can control the percentage of deductibility for the investor to control investment-driven inflation exactly the way the governor of the Reserve Bank controls inflation by controlling the prime rate of interest. You could control housing inflation driven by the investor and over a period of time, move it to a wage earner competing with wage earner for housing as a shelter segment. And one of the ideas was also to use, you'd be able to use your super. And I had a great meeting with Malcolm Turnbull, and he'd said, oh, this is the stupidest idea he'd ever had. So I've finally got a meeting with him and we're sitting there. I said, oh, well, look, I'll start off with this one because you've said it's the stupidest idea that you've ever heard. And if you still think that, well, I'll be gone in 5 minutes. And the point of difference I put forward to Malcolm was that if you're allowed to use super, it's not taking money out of super to buy your house. In using super, we came up with this idea of having a super mortgage where your super could contribute to the principal component of your mortgage. But in that case, the house was then seen as a super asset and therefore assessable in regard to your applying for the age pension later on. And the number one issue that determines poverty in retirement is if you don't own your own property. So being able to use your super to buy your first home and to have that little nest egg sitting there made an enormous amount of sense. And yeah, okay, so the attacker will say, well, then you're just going to heat up the market. And then you say, well, that's because you weren't listening to the first part where you've got a lever that reduces the percentage of deductibility to cool the investment. So we had these counterbalancing mechanisms and stabilizing mechanisms. One of the stabilizing mechanisms was we needed to have more people in fixed rate mortgages, and those mortgages needed to be over a longer period of time. They're 30 years in the US. You know, even if we just had 10 years mortgages that were available at a fixed rate, that would be a stabilizing mechanism. But get these ideas out, make them common knowledge, let people debate these things over to, you know, summer barbecues, and then judge those people who are seeking office on, are they engaging in these debates? Are they coming up with real reasons? Not, you know, the trash that we see where, you know, the facts the first casualty of every debate. I mean, how infantile the debate was over nuclear energy. I mean, the incorrect information put forward, not to pick on the Labor Party, but it was just an absurd argument to say anything just to win the argument. That when it was so untrue, I kept on putting out that it was, $600 billion to build these things. It was just not true. And that's where, you know, our politicians lose credibility. I mean, as I said, my little bit nemesis, yeah, the number one thing you expect of your politicians is that they have integrity, they have honesty, they're trustworthy. And, you know, if somebody's got a Bible in the hand, you probably expect that in spades, and it's not what we've had in recent times. And so, you know, I think Anthony is a really decent guy, and I think if he would engage in these things, he's got a mandate that he could lead this country in a way where we go back to being a fairer society. You know, instead of, you know, make America great, we could say make Australia fair again, or, you know, make Australia a Commonwealth again. I think that has, you know, huge appeal. But it's got to be started, and it's got to be started with as much education as you give to people to understand what value capture is, to understand how you generate housing supply. You hear the argument all the time, oh, here's the problem. Don't tell me the problem again. And you might not like my ideas, but don't tell me my ideas aren't any good unless you've got something that's better. And then we've got a contest of ideas. And if I've only just kicked the argument, yeah, the competition started and somebody comes up with much better ideas, great, fantastic.
Yeah, I spoke to Gerard Rennick, and he was another guy like you that had some original ideas around a sovereign wealth fund, and, you know, but, you know, again, he just got smashed politically, which is a shame. You know, I mean, I was interested in your comment about Albanese. You think he's a great guy. I mean, I totally disagree. I think he's a terrible leader, but, you know, I don't know him, so I got a
leader. I said he's got good bloke.
He might be a good bloke, but Jesus, some of the stuff that's coming out of Canberra, I'm like, dude, you know, what are you doing? Like, you're bankrupting this country from under people's feet, and in the name of political correctness, and the ridiculous stuff coming out of Canberra for business owners. It's just like, I represent small business owners. That's my passion. I just think they're the most underappreciated, abused workhorses that get, you know, dumped into the same category as big business. They're going broke left, right, and center. It's, the compliance is out of control. The people who are actually producing are just getting absolutely fed up with funding these left socialist bullshit policies, and that's why I was surprised. Yeah, he might be a good bloke, but he's bankrupting the country, in my opinion.
This, when I was first campaigning and door knocking in 2010, and, you know, we door knocked 10,000 homes, and, you know, some of my colleagues, they'd say they door knocked, but it was their office that door knocked. I actually did the door knocking. The first thing I learned on the first day, I'd had my old shoes resoled in rubber. And I found out after the one day, I was wearing my Dunlop Volley OCs. But what we learned door knocking, talking to people, and all the issue at the time was, you know, global warming and, you know, green energy and stuff. Two people in 10,000 homes raised that as an issue. And I should have worked out, because one of them had a Prius in front, and the other was a wife of a famous cricketer, whose name I won't mention, but she was really hostile towards the Liberal Party. But what I'm seeing now, and it take about 8 weeks to get through into the press, I've got a great mate who's a very well-known banker in the Southern Highlands, and he said in Robertson, 3/4 of the small businesses have closed down. And when you put your eye to it and you go around and you start looking for it, you're seeing it happening everywhere. Here in Balmain, where I live, there's probably 3 or 4 of the coffee shops have gone broke in recent times. It's a little barometer that's telling you things aren't great. You know, the cost of compliance, the cost of doing business, cost of employing people.
The worker protections, like, it's, people can't hire them anymore. Like, Australians can't afford Australians. And that too is hollowing out the culture. The corner milk bar is gone. You know, you don't go in and get a bag of lollies from, you know, your mate's grandmother who runs the shop. You know, like, all these little businesses are just going broke left and right. Anyway, I don't want to go. It's an interview with you, but it's just so frustrating. And we need to, you know, encourage business and innovation. It's just gone to pot. But anyway, that's sort of by the by. I mean, I just listen to Australians every single day, and they're absolutely sick of immigration without a solution around housing. They're absolutely sick of the housing cost right across the board. Even the people with housing are getting sick of it, because they can see what it's doing to the country. And it just seems that Canberra is not listening and there's no solutions coming out of Canberra. And what you suggested on our phone call, I'd love to do something like that where you said, let's get some people like Philip Lowe and yourself and John Howard and people from the other side of the political aisle as well and get a decent moderator, has some balls that can actually keep everybody on track towards the objective rather than, you know, turn it politicizing it. I'd love, I don't know how we can facilitate that, John, but if you have any ideas, we would be all in to support that.
I think we call it the All-Stars, and you get Philip Lowe, you get Ken Henry, you can get John Howard, Mark Burrows, a banker who's got, you know, the most extraordinary project to water Northern Australia. But even he, with his background, can't get traction to get government to act on these really well thought through ideas that would mean so much. And, you know, to have an honest, I watched Chris Allman being interviewed the other day. I don't know if it was on your show, but he made so much sense when he talked about energy and the frailty of going all green, and that it won't work, and it's virtuous signalling, and all it's going to do is destroy our economy for no benefit. And the lying that goes on with that when if we don't stop burning coal, we'll lose the barrier reef. It doesn't matter what we do. It's a global problem. It needs a global solution. The lie of, you know, if we do this, we save our land. That's untrue.
Total bullshit. Like, and Gerard Rennick talks about this, and we've got a lot of smart people in this country, but we're not bringing them together, and we need to bring them together in an apolitical environment and start solving these problems. And this is what I was getting at with Canberra. They're virtue signaling at the expense of Australia, at the expense of the average family that can't even afford to bloody feed themselves or have any kids. You know, marriage rates are dropping, enrollments in militaries falling away, the middle class is being hollowed out, and immigration's, you know, unchecked. And these are the things that are frustrating the average Australian right now. Anyway, John, is there anything else you want to leave us with, mate? Any words of wisdom?
We're in furious agreement, and I've really enjoyed meeting you and talking with you, and so grateful to have my little say, and I just hope it stimulates others to come forward with ideas and make this a place, a contest of ideas, and push it through to those who have been, you know, given the privilege and the responsibility of looking after our future, and that they should be concentrating on that, not just denigrating the other side. So hopefully there is a change. I hope it doesn't, we don't have to go to a point where we are really devastated before we have to make a change. Yeah. Anticipate, well, I was having a very funny conversation, last little comment, segue with Malcolm, and he was talking about, we need to be agile. We're talking about agile, and I'm going, no. You only need to be agile if you can't anticipate what's going to happen. And when you do say, make certain questions at question time, you can anticipate the answer. You don't have to be agile and chase it down. You can be standing there waiting for it. But, you know, you've got to understand the cause and effect. When you do certain things, this is what's going to happen. And you don't have to, you know, be dumb and then have to, you know, be agile. You can be ready for the next policy to address that situation that you've actually made arise. And I think that's the, we've got to be proactive, not reactive, is the thing. And we've got to start planning and investing in infrastructure in a way that it is self-funding. If a value capture mechanism can't fund some piece of infrastructure, good, don't do it. But it's very easy to do the sums to work out how much of the funding will arrive from a value capture. There was a great example of a wharf being built in Phillip Bay, in Port Phillip Bay. And the land uplift that would happen around that wharf of government-owned land alone more than funded the building of the wharf. And yet people are always running around saying, because the Cross City Rail raised 30% of the cost of the infrastructure through a levy on businesses alone. And Tim Williams, who was in charge of that, said, oh, he said, I'm lauded all the time because I raised 30%. He says, "Let me tell you, I stuffed up royally." He's English. I was English briefly. He stuffed up royally. Had I had an impost on the uplift of the value of land, we would have funded the entire thing. And you know, that's where an understanding of how value capture works to fund infrastructure is so important. And it's such a fair and just mechanism to have in place to protect the taxpayer and not concentrate wealth.
This is where you can't have career politicians in Canberra running around that haven't had a day's experience in business running the country. You need people who actually have an understanding of how business works as well, in my opinion. That's, you know, it's just not being run in any way. I don't think you can run a government like a business completely, but we do need some commercials brought into the way things are being done, or we're not going to fix these problems. John, do you tweet, or are you on socials anywhere actively, or is anywhere people can follow you?
No. I'm an old geek. I don't know anything about that. My kids tell me about things like that.
Well, if you have any of your mates who've got interesting voices, mate, from either side of the political aisle, please think of us, because we'd love to have a chat with them. Podcasting is the way of the future. We're getting a lot of traction, a lot of views, and it might feel like it's just you and I talking, but tens of thousands of people are going to see this and hear this across the interwebs. So please point them our direction, because we exist to hear these voices that have got something to say based on real life experience.
Okay, I'll circulate it to a couple of friends. I think Ken Henry would make a great interview. I think I've never met him, but we talk on the phone like we're the oldest buddies, and we probably are old, but we agree on this path forward and what should be done. Yeah. Yeah, tax reform, and then he looks at value capture. He says, "Oh, that's a beauty," yeah, and it's positive. You know, the conversation seems to grow when we talk. And you know, Philip Lowe, who was when I was first dealing with Glenn Stevens as the head of the economics committee, he was the deputy governor, and very highly intelligent guy. And that one thought of his in answering that question that we need to not allow politics to interfere with great projects and still birth them. And if they can't work in a bipartisan way, then they default the position and should give to this independent body.
Well, guys like you, please, mate, do more of this. Don't sit on the sidelines, because Australia needs your ideas, and they're not coming from young people yet, mate. You know, so please keep doing pods. Please keep pushing the barrel, because it's so helpful, and it's only this kind of thing. When it comes from a lifetime of experience, it's going to make change. So thank you. We appreciate you.
Great talk to you, Adam.
You too, mate. Cheers. Hey there. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Unemployable. If you'd like to watch another episode, just click there.